Have you ever had someone refer to something going on in the community who asked you, what's going on there? What's the story with all that? The right answer lies with the people directly involved in it, the people who know. Why not hear their story? So welcome to What's the Story, Pekin? I'm Gary Gillis, your host, and I hope you enjoy this Pekin podcast. A week or two ago, early June, I received an email from someone who informed me of a social service that I was not aware of. And I thought and asked myself, what's the story with that? And I thought we'd share it with listeners today. It was from a gentleman by the name of Ryan Lacerna who told me about CASA, which is an organization that is associated with the 10th Judicial Circuit. A little background in the email that he told me, he said they opened their doors in 2005. And in 2018, they expanded to serve Tazewell County and opened an office in downtown Pekin. That office grew from serving zero children in the area to 240 in 2022. So I asked Ryan to join us and tell us a little bit about CASA, which stands for Court-Appointed Special Advocate. It's a great story and one I'm glad he's here to share with us today. Ryan, welcome.
Thanks, Gary. Appreciate you having me on.
Well, tell us then a little bit about, you know, the title gives a lot of it away, but maybe the operational aspects of what you do and maybe how it came about first and then what you do.
Sure. Well, I'll start, I guess, way back in 1977 with Superior Court Judge David Sukup out in Seattle, Washington. He was a juvenile judge, and he was running into an issue in his courtroom in that he would have to make critical decisions about a child's life and not have all of the information needed to make those decisions. And these were decisions that were, you know, impacting the trajectory of that child's life. Do we go left? Do we go right? And he's spoken at conferences before and said he would lose sleep over that reality. So he came up with this radical idea to recruit everyday citizens to be his boots on the ground, eyes and ears out in the field, to get him that information so he can make the most appropriate decision. I love this part of the story. He asked his bailiff to call for a brown bag luncheon, ask for members of the community who would be interested in a program like this. And he expected only a handful of people to show up. But when that day came in 1977, 50 people attended. From there, the CASA movement has expanded, you know, nationwide to over 900 local programs. And in the state of Illinois, we're currently one of the larger ones, I believe the fifth or sixth largest behind some suburban counties. So the story of CASA here locally in this region started in 2005, like you had mentioned. Pam Perillis, who's still our executive director to this day, opened the doors as a one-person shop in the Peoria County Courthouse. And then we received some funding through the Victims of Crime Act, which are federal funds, which we were able to use to expand to the entirety of the 10th Circuit. And for those who may not know, the 10th Circuit is Peoria, Tazewell, Stark, Marshall, and Putnam. So previously we had just served Peoria, but we were able to serve Tazewell County now, and then Stark, Marshall, and Putnam counties up north. But in Tazewell County in 2018, we were surprised to kind of hear the numbers that were in Tazewell County, you know, the number of kids in the child welfare system. At the time in 18, there was around 463 kids. You know, that's a lot of kids in our backyard. And, you know, since 2018, we've seen a surge, an increase over the years, a lot of it due to COVID, a lot of it due to, you know, poverty and some of the systemic issues in this community. We opened not serving any kids, and in 2021, 2022, we were serving between 200, 300 kids, both of those years.
So it would be accurate to describe them, for lack of maybe a lesser known term, as troubled youth. Give us a background of these kids. Where they come from, demographic, basically.
So our kids are children who have experienced abuse and or neglect, not necessarily, okay, you know, trouble youth. Okay. I would say, you know, kids who have definitely been in troubled situations, right, who have experienced, you know, that trauma.
So not versus being troublemakers themselves, right, but they've been more the victims of that.
Correct. Okay. Gotcha. Yeah. So, you know, these are kids who at the hands of, you know, their caregivers or family members, people close to them, you know, who experience that trauma, that
abuse. So abused kids, basically.
Yes. Yeah. And a lot of these kids, you know, still remain with their family of origin. Those are called intact cases, but a lot of them are removed from their homes and then go into the foster care system. Okay. So they're with relatives, traditional foster placements. Sometimes, children have needs that require a residential placement. Okay.
Mm-hmm. So you are that special advocate, as the title indicates. Right. So what services do you offer? Let's say a child comes into your care as directed by a judge. What are the steps in the process? What happens?
Yeah. So our program, we're a unique volunteer organization. We've got a memorandum of understanding with the 10th Judicial Circuit Court that allows us to operate. From there, the juvenile judges in the courtrooms that we work in appoint CASA to cases that they see fit. You know, where there's significant issues that need to be addressed, where an extra set of eyes and ears would be beneficial. So we're assigned at any point in a juvenile abuse neglect case. But from there, we employ our volunteer advocates who go through a 30-hour training. They get sworn in as officers of the court, and they begin working with these children and with these families. And the main goal, the purpose of a CASA, is just to provide an extra layer of security and safety, a safety net for these kids. Our advocates go into the homes wherever the children are placed, report on the conditions of the home. Is the child getting fed? Are they going to school? Are they doing well in school? Are they making it to their medical appointments? And we document all of those things in a narrative, in a court report, which then gets submitted to the court, and everyone involved in that child's life, the people who are making decisions, to provide everyone the context and, again, that critical information, so that everyone remembers that the child should be first and foremost at the front of decisions. Mm-hmm. And that should be our North Star, is their best interest.
Okay. So once you have the responsibility for this child, do you have input or direction in terms of that home they've been entrusted to? You share the dynamic of what's taking place there, but do you have any authority to report to the court those things that you think are lacking, and then to turn to that family or that household and say, here's the things that you should be doing, those best practices, if you will?
We do. Currently, though, we don't give any direct recommendations to the court. We provide them with concerns in our court report, highlighting the significant issues that need to be addressed. A unique thing about our report, which I'll mention, is we have a section called Child's Wishes. So, if the child's of age to express, what they want, it might be as silly as, I want to become an astronaut when I grow up. We'll put that in our court report, sure. Right? But if it's a more significant thing, I don't feel safe going home to, parent A, then we will also let that be known to the court and see if there's, anything to address this concern that this child has.
So is there a timetable for each student? I mean, does it run till they of legal age, or is there kind of a defining moment or set of circumstances where you step away? And then do you report to the court that, they perhaps have to sign off and say, yes, this child now can be entrusted to their own care, mm-hmm. and direction, or how does that all work?
So the legal proceedings are very similar to, a criminal case, but juvenile court is not an adversarial model. It's a civil court. So there's, the typical procedural hearings at the beginning, and then you have what's called an adjudication and disposition hearing, which is essentially the trial and sentencing for the parent or the individual, the alleged perpetrator of the abuse and or neglect. From there, every 6 months, there's what's called a permanency review hearing that's scheduled. And, that's where our reports come into play. We submit reports to those permanency review hearings, and the court, the judge, the attorneys in the room all decide on, what's the direction we need to go to achieve permanency as quickly as possible for this child? And permanency is, getting back to a getting that child back to a stable, safe, loving environment. So our reports, you know, just provide extra data, you know, to make those decisions.
So if a child reaches legal age, but, you know, they're still obviously perhaps not, don't have the resources to go off on their own and live independently, and they're in an environment that you feel there may be the potential for some trouble or hostility, do you report that to the court? And then what's the outcome of that?
Well, hopefully that situation is pretty rare. You know, thankfully in the state of Illinois, if we have a child who is, you know, nearing the age of emancipation, which is 18 or 21, the DCFS, CASA will all be involved in the plan to make sure that this child can transition to adulthood successfully. So, you know, working with DCFS to get, you know, services in place, financial services, housing, job and employment, before that child ages out and is no longer a part of the system and no longer has, you know, eyes on them, making sure that they're okay. So the court, and when I say 18 or 21, you know, when a child turns 18, if there's a situation where, you know, okay, we need a little bit more time with, you know, court involvement, DCFS involvement to get that older youth the services they need, then the judge will typically order, okay, we'll keep this youth in care until 21 to get those services.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, to put it in the right context, do you have a success story that you could share without defying, you know, any confidences?
Yes.
Or just an example, or perhaps even create a fictitious child that's based on experience so people can really visualize and understand the outcome of the service?
When you asked me that, three jumped out at me straight away, and I won't, you know, name any any names, and I'll just refer to the youth or the child. The first is, you know, a child who I actually worked with when I first started with CASA back in 2016. He's an older youth. He had been in a residential facility his almost his entire life, it seemed like, but I'm trying to remember when he first went to a residential facility, but he suffered some, you know, severe medical neglect at the hands of his mother, and had some other issues which caused him to be in a residential facility. And I remember I would go see him, and the facility is, you know, 2.5 hours away, so I'd make a trip of it to go see him. And you know, we would talk and we would chat. I would check in to see how he's doing with school, how he's doing with, you know, his counseling and therapy services. And then, you know, we would just talk. We would go outside. If the weather was nice, I brought a football in my trunk that I would break out and we would play catch with. And I remember this young man just, you know, telling me that he wanted to get out, just have a normal high school experience. And that he wanted to, you know, see his mom, and the neglect which had occurred, that was, you know, years ago, but he had come to a point where, you know, he wanted to still have that relationship with his mother, and he was old enough at a point where he understood, you know, the challenges that his mother faced. So I would put that in a court report. And, you know, at one of the permanency review hearings that I was speaking about, the judge, well, let me back up here. So there was a no contact order between him and his mother. And, you know, the judge read my report, read the caseworker's report, spoke to the youth because he was there. He was transported from that residential facility. And he lifted that contact order and allowed contact between that youth and his mother. And I remember the first hug that took place in the courtroom, and there was not a dry eye in that courtroom, including my own. You know, it was a very emotional moment. The mother, you know, was still working on herself. She was in treatment. But just to have that connection for that youth, you know, you could tell that it meant the world to him because he still loved his mother, and still, you know, if at all possible, wanted to go home. You know, years later, unfortunately, that wasn't the case. But, you know, I mentioned we would play football, do other physical activities. I remember we would have he would challenge me to push-ups, and I would do significantly less than him. But he said that he wanted to, you know, have that high school experience and then go into the military when he turned 18. And you know, I transitioned roles during my time at CASA, but I remember keeping up with this case. And when he did turn 18, when he left that residential facility, he spent a little bit of time in an actual high school, but he joined the Army National Guard after that. And I ended up seeing him, I think it was only like 2 years ago, at a restaurant, and he told me about, yeah, he's still in the Army National Guard. He's you know, doing well,
sure,
living on his own, self-sufficient. So that's one story. And you know, I could think of other stories too. Sure. And I won't go into as much depth as
it sounds like. In a nutshell, really, you are the eyes and ears that the judge doesn't have the time, the resources to really do a deep dive on what really is making this whole relationship happen, whether it's, you know, good or bad. So I appreciate all that you do. How's your organization funded, and do you solicit private donations?
Yep, we do. We're funded through a few different sources. Grants are a big one. Have to shout out United Way of Pekin, because we're a grant recipient of them. Heart of Illinois, United Way, VCVA. I mentioned the VOCA funding, which we no longer have, but it received in the past. We receive funds through our Illinois CASA Association, through DCFS, so state funds. And then we've got, you know, some individual donors, private donors. We have fundraising events throughout the year. Our big premier fundraising event is Casablanca, Dancing with the Local Stars. Every first Saturday in November, we set up at the Paradise Hotel and Casino, and we invite leaders of the community to be our dancers, and then we pair them up with instructors. So last year, for example, we had Chief Echeverria from the Peoria Police Department as one of our dancers. I didn't get to see his dance, but I heard it was pretty good with him. He didn't end up winning, though.
Well, I can tell you, do not send me an invitation. I will not respond. I think Mike Eaton would certainly be willing. I see Mike sitting here and his eyes lit up when you mentioned that. Yeah. But it sounds like a great event and a lot of fun and very creative. Yeah. So
Mike looks like he's light on his feet. So
yes,
yeah.
He's told me that a number of times. So, well, Ryan, thank you for being here, and thank you for all you do, and especially letting the community know more about this essential and very beneficial service. So thank you very much.
Thank you for having me, Gary.
And thank you to you, the listener, for joining us today. Feel free to send us your thoughts and comments, especially recommendations perhaps for guests. There are a lot of people in Pekin who have a story to share, and we look forward to hearing it. Send it to us at pekinpodcast@gmail.com. Thanks to Mike Eaton, our sound guy, who's here always before me and takes a good ribbing. I appreciate that. And thank you to Pekin Library for providing us the space, as they always do. So thanks for listening, and have a great day.